to The Playlist. I'm your host, Fiona Williams, and I'm editor of SBS Movies, and I'm joined by my co-host and SBS TV Guide editor, Nick Bassine.
Hello.
Hi, Nick.
Fiona, I'm so glad I showed up to work today because this episode, I know I say it every episode.
Yeah, I've noticed.
But this is the one that's going to do it. We've got such an amazing episode. We're talking to the unbelievably delightful Sarain Fox about her show, her new show, new Viceland show, Rise, and a whole bunch of other wildly entertaining subjects. She was fantastic. But first, I don't know if you're familiar with this film, this new film, Dunkirk, came out last week.
Mm-hmm.
Still getting rave reviews. People can't stop talking about it. It's making all kinds of business at the box office. What did you think of it?
Christopher Nolan has a cheer squad. People latch on. And going into this film, leading up to it, you know, like
who's the cheer squad?
There is a thing with Christopher Nolan's films, and a lot of directors have their immediate fan bases and people who immediately rush to the defense of a director or just love it on the mere fact of they're making a film. So that in itself is extraordinary and beyond criticism.
I'm actually in one of those for McG.
It struck me going into Dunkirk that there didn't appear to be as much of that this time. You know, with Interstellar, there was so much hype around the films going in the lead up to his releases. And so going into Dunkirk, 70 mil films, I love the theatre of going to see a 70 mil projection film.
You must have noticed the difference, I guess. I couldn't tell where I was supposed to be looking to know the difference. This makes me sound like a real dummy, I know.
No. Well, the size, for one thing, of it on the screen. It just doesn't have that digital look. But, of course, some digital films have filtered. I do love the scale of his films, and Dunkirk certainly has that. You know, you get the immense scale of 400,000 stranded soldiers and the sounds. It's an immersive kind of experience watching the film. I don't think he's all that accomplished in telling smaller stories. Like, I think that macro and micro kind of the way those stories come together, the enormous scale compared to the human individual's fate, I don't think they quite connect that well.
I had a problem connecting to the characters and having an emotional response aside from just great tension and relief you know, when it was over. But they don't have those moments where G.I. Johnny brings out the picture of his dame back in Brooklyn. And that's his sweetheart. And so, he wants to get back home to his
sweetheart.
And then.
No.
So there's none of that kind of thing is not in this movie at all. Did you feel like you were missing that?
No, I don't mind that.
Not the cliches necessarily, but.
The emotional attachment does come through Mark Rylance plays.
That's right.
Plays one of the ordinary guys who comes out. His boat is commandeered by the Navy, and he takes his son and a friend out to go and save the fellas across the channel. And Mark Rylance, he's got those beautiful sad eyes, and I do think they do most of the heavy lifting in this film in terms of emotional attachment. Like most of his acting is through his eyes. He doesn't say a lot in this. Christopher Nolan owes a lot to Mark Rylance for that. It's good casting.
Did you feel anything from that storyline by the end of it? I don't want to give away what happened.
Sure, yeah. No, that has a play. And, it is quite touching in parts. I just think broadly, I didn't come out and think that was amazing. I think it's very good, but there are scenes where Kenneth Branagh is standing on a pier. He's the naval captain and he's sort of the last man waiting. Everyone, you know, like sort of like a captain is the last one to depart the ship. He's the last guy waiting till everyone's safely off. We see his response to some of the action. So like there's German pilots circling and they're all sitting ducks really, but he's watching that happen and there's some relief. And then he sees the fleet of boats coming to save them, like all the little dinghies and everyone in their all types of boats. That when he sees that, and that should be a beautiful moment, it felt a little corny. It felt a little awkward.
I felt almost nothing except oppressed during most of this movie. And I think it's a great technical achievement. It's beautiful. The music's amazing. The sound effects are incredible. It's nice that you don't have a lot of the cliches. There's not a lot of blood. It's all kinds of great things about it. But I just didn't feel all that much about it throughout or at the end. And when all the dinghies show up, I knew they were coming.
Well, yeah.
I didn't feel like the biggest emotional moment I had was at one point when it occurred to me that Harry Styles was in this.
Yeah.
Was in it. I didn't realize it was him for
really?
Maybe the first three quarters. Yeah. Huh. I just suddenly occurred, and I leaned over to the woman I was with, and I said, is that Harry Styles? And that was it. That was me recreating that moment. The movie has divided people in France. They don't like the way... I mean, it's very British-focused. There's the French soldiers aren't allowed on the boat in the movie, which was a strange moment. Also, as a side note, there is zero context given to what this battle meant and what was at stake.
Oh, yeah.
Until, I think, maybe the very end with Churchill's speech.
Mm.
But anyway, so the French aren't all that happy about it.
Oh, this is... solely an evacuation kind of film, and like an escape and evacuation story. It's intentionally exclusively British. Yeah, there is a couple of French characters. You don't see the Germans. You sort of see the planes and see some bullets, but you don't actually see any German soldiers.
Right.
And I do think the little lines where there's British only and Harry gets a couple of choice borderline racist things to say to a French character. Yeah, I think that takes it out of being too flag-wavy, jingoistic, because it's awkward when you see those moments. So I think it does tackle that it is unashamedly British, but it's not in a really clichéd, rah-rah, Rule Britannia kind of way.
The other thing everybody's talking about, aside from James Cromwell getting arrested over and over again, is the Justice League reshoots.
Yes, the rumored $25 million US cost of the reshoots for the upcoming Justice League, because Joss Whedon has taken over because Zack Snyder obviously had a family tragedy, and so Joss stepped in. And the film has required some reshooting. However, since it wrapped, old Superman, Henry Cavill, has moved on to a new film, Mission Impossible, for which he's had to grow a considerable amount of facial hair.
Isn't this, before we get to the facial hair, isn't this one huge spoiler?
What?
Because Superman's not in any of the trailers or anything. I guess
well,
we're just supposed to
also
assume that he's coming back in this movie. I didn't know he was coming back in this movie, and now I do. Right?
You didn't know?
No, I didn't know.
Huh.
Nobody knew.
I knew. I think we knew. Do you mean you thought he was dead and that was the end of Superman Forever?
No, I thought he was going to come back, but I didn't know if he was going to come back in this movie. There's going to be 500 other movies. I thought he'd just come back in something else.
Well, he is.
I didn't know for sure.
Well, now you do. And he's going to have some digital trickery applied to his face, because rather than shave...
Now, there's a third option that hasn't been explored that producer Dan and I were talking about earlier. He should just Cesar Romero it and paint right over it. Get some flesh tone paint.
Well, that's what you do with eyebrows too.
Is that right?
Yeah. Ask a drag queen.
That's
there's
the title
a lot
of
tutorials.
Our next podcast.
There's a lot of tutorials on YouTube, about, certainly for masking eyebrows and whatnot, for 20s makeup and whatnot.
Oh, really?
You soap or Yoo-hoo glue. And you may well ask, why doesn't he just shave? But Paramount is producing Mission Impossible. They won't let him anywhere near a razor blade. So the solution is a very costly one, in that they have to digitally remove the moustache, beard, whatever it is that he's sprouted for Superman in Justice League. So coming up now, we are going to have a conversation with Serene Carson Fox, an Anishinaabe activist and artist who uses her profile to explore contemporary Indigenous communities. She'd be familiar to SBS Viceland audiences for her documentary Cut Off, which was the first program to screen here when the channel launched last year. That was about Indigenous youth communities in Canada, and in particular reserves where they don't have access to clean drinking water. But anyway, she's back this week on Viceland with a new series called Rise, which is a series of weekly documentaries about Native American communities and the ways they're rising up against corporations such as mining companies who are using increasingly brazen methods to seize sacred lands.
Serene, thanks for joining us on the playlist.
Thank you so much. Chimigwech.
I'm sorry?
Chimigwech.
What does that mean?
Thank you. Oh,
fantastic.
Yeah, an Ojibwe.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
How long have you been in the country?
I think I'm going on like 6 hours.
Oh,
you just got here.
Yeah.
Are you all...
jet-lagged and lovely. It's my first 6 hours in Australia ever.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, welcome.
Thank you.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Now you're here to do a presentation at Splendor in the Grass.
Yeah,
you're
and then Rise launches next Thursday.
Yes.
So, yeah, I'm here for all that good stuff.
What's going on at Splendor in the Grass? What are you?
Well, I'm going to be speaking on a panel, and I think that it'll be interesting because I think the only Canadian representative, but it's about being Indigenous or being Black, as they call it here.
Yes.
At the moment in the world, so yeah, young. And Indigenous, brown or black or red, as some people call us.
Right. Yeah. I've heard that.
And you know, tell us about what got you started on your activism journey. Sort of, what's your background and how did you get on your path?
Yeah, so you know, I have my mom and my community to thank for that. So I was raised in a very traditional household. I was raised in my culture with my teachings, which is actually a very privileged place to come from in Canada, because so much of our teachings and our culture has been lost. So to actually grow up with it and not have to find it in your adult years is quite a privilege. So I was really grateful for my mom advocating for that. So inherently, I was just incredibly political. I was raised to never stand for the Canadian anthem, never say I was Canadian. I refer to myself as a sovereign Indigenous person. So I had that sort of political background. And then I grew up in the arts. I went to private school for ballet and was a dancer. I'm still dancing. But my work in the arts and sort of activism and storytelling is what brought me to Viceland. And I started doing sort of more journalistic reporting. So I think it was just all of my background and the current state of the world that brought me to the work that I'm doing right now.
Yeah. So what kind of community did you grow up in? It's outside of Toronto, is that?
Yeah, so I'm north of Toronto, but my reserve is called Batchewana First Nation.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's in northern Ontario on the shores of Lake Superior.
And is it rural or is it?
So my reserve has two parts. One part of it is pretty close to the city. And then we are also on a bay, which is rural. But okay. In terms of how the majority of First Nations reserves are, it's quite close to town. It's not as remote as it gets. So.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. When I say I was raised in my culture, what I mean is that I was raised going to my lodge. I'm Midewin. Midewin is the oldest medicine society. It's the truest, sort of most ancient form of Ojibwe beliefs. So I was raised in that world. I was given my traditional name, Wabananongokwe, when I was really young and was raised to sort of refer to myself as that. So all of the things that were taken from us as Indigenous people were given back to me through my mom, which was... It's a revolutionary act because she didn't grow up with that. And we are, my family, all of them experienced residential schools. So residential schools were where children were forcibly removed from their homes. And the idea was to save the child, kill the Indian. So save the Indian and the child.
Right.
There was a similar phenomenon here, right?
Yeah. What's your awareness of Australia's own history of, with the,
from what I understand, it's
history with
very,
Indigenous
very
population.
Similar. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very, very similar. So, and I understand that even the way that it was worked up in the apology is very similar. So, right. In Canada, the apology meant nothing to the majority of Indigenous people in Canada because it came with no real action. So what happened from the apology, the good thing that came of it was the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which basically went through all of the stories from survivors. And that led to a recent report that came out 2 years ago called the Truth and Reconciliation Recommendations. And there are 94 recommendations that all of Canada are supposed to follow if they want to truly... engage in reconciliation.
How many of those have they followed?
Not very many.
Okay.
But I will say that the conversation around reconciliation is happening and it is on the forefront of everything right now in Canada. So I think that conversation is really valuable. What needs to stop happening is the conversation. Mm. And what needs to start happening is the action. You know, how do we move forward and how do we let Indigenous people lead the way forward instead of trying to lead it for them? You know?
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
When was that the apology, all that?
I think that was about seven, eight years ago. Yeah. If you ask my mom about that, it infuriates her. In our, dinner time conversations, my mom just cannot talk about that apology. She has it laminated, and she's a teacher. She's the elder at Sir Wilfrid Laurier University in Canada, and she gives it out to her students, and she analyzes it, because you can't really apologize for that kind of treatment in a statement with nothing else attached to it. Like, what does that mean? And I think as an Indigenous person, I even have to look at, what do words mean? What does the colonial language as an apology actually mean to our communities? The truth is that it probably should have been done within the communities. If you want a real apology, you have to go and apologize to those people. It can't just be a massive one-off.
And on to Rise, really the meticulously researched and, exhaustively fascinating stories that you document in the series. Can we talk about the resistance, but the resilience, and just kind of what you want to make in this series? That's a ridiculous question, but tell us about Rise.
Well, first of all, I have to say that Rise was backed by an incredible team. My director, Michelle Latimer, and everyone who worked on the series was just bang on. The amount of research, like you said, but in particular, the amount of Indigenous-led research that went into the show was really important. Rise showcases Indigenous resistance and resilience across North America, and it brings viewers to the front lines of those communities. And I think we've never seen that from an Indigenous perspective on a worldwide scale, not with this kind of platform. The stories have always been told about us, about Indigenous people being the protesters, the aggravators, So I think with Rise, it's important to tell the backstory. And it's important for the narrative to come from Indigenous people. So that's important.
When I was watching it, just on a visceral level, I was struck by how many Indigenous faces you get to see and how many different kinds of people you get to hear from that you don't normally hear from. Even in a news report, it'll be kind of superficial and cursory. Mm-hmm. But this really gets into it. And certainly in other TV and movies, you don't get that kind of experience.
Yeah, I think we've been left out of the narrative for a really long time. And I think that's how I feel in Canada. And I think that's pretty widespread. I'm sure if I talk to Aboriginal people here, they would have the same kind of feeling, the way that colonialism was designed was to cut us out of that history. I think that it was designed that way. So, that's one of the reasons why it's important for these kinds of stories to make it onto the mainstream. But also, can you imagine what it must be like? This is what I always think of, is to be a young Indigenous person and to turn on the TV and to see your own people, on a mainstream channel. That, to me, if Rise does that, that's enough. Yeah, because I didn't grow up with any of that on TV. There was no, I was lucky because I was led to Indigenous role models. But if I wasn't, there was no one. Mm. I wasn't seeing that anywhere,
Yeah. In the show, what are you up against? You don't have to tell the whole story, the whole thing. You want to leave a little bit for the audience.
Yeah.
What are the challenges?
I mean, you mean in general of making it, or like the challenges of Indigenous people, I think?
You go to certain areas and...
Yes, I gotcha.
So, yeah.
So I think that in Rise, we're really showcasing Indigenous people who are up against big industry, extractive industries, and government policies that quite often force them to live in unsafe in third world living conditions that would not be acceptable in anywhere in North America, yet Indigenous people face and live in them every single day. They're also up against the general public, who has a very misguided and romanticized image of Indigenous people, and sort of changing that so that we become real human beings is important. You know, we're as Indigenous people in Canada, we're dealing with a lot of appropriation. You know, everyone wants to be Native until it's actually time to be Native. You know, everyone wants to put on a headdress because it looks cool.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
But nobody wants to go to the front line and put their fist in the air when, you know, when there's a pipeline being built through your home. So I think that was one of my favorite lines that came out from Standing Rock is everybody wants to be Indian until it's time to be Indian.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And on Standing Rock, I mean, that's, we're aware of it here. That's, you know, probably the most widely known instance. But in Rise, there's a lot of similar situations going on that you're detailing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, do you see connections between the affected communities and sort of you'd see sort of the lines?
We landed in Standing Rock last year in early May, so before the sort of world was aware of what was going on. And the interesting thing about that is that I had two things happened. I was in Brazil, and we were covering the worst environmental disaster they've had in their history, which was a tailings mining spill that destroyed a river. And so I had just come from this Indigenous community, Krenak community, where their river, their Watu, their most sacred entity that provided everything for that community, was gone. It was destroyed. And I flew from Brazil, literally from there, to Shoal Lake 40 to do cutoff. So I spent 2 days with the Prime Minister fighting over water rights. And then I went straight to Standing Rock. So for a month before I arrived at Standing Rock, I was really seeing the other side. And at Standing Rock, you know, their river is pristine. It's beautiful. It's, the landscape is gorgeous. And so for me to have this parallel, here's a community that's fighting to protect this. And I know what it's like when it's no longer savable. So to have that in the back of my mind always was really hard. It was hard because every time someone said, this river will be destroyed, that's what I thought of. And I think until you've seen it, until you've actually seen water that is dead and no longer savable ever in our lifetimes, in anyone's lifetime, then that's when things become really real. And then I saw that happen all across North America. It was like we're fighting for the same things. And it's really, really hard to stay positive, to be honest. It's incredibly difficult.
The series has been out a little while in the U.S., right, in North America.
Yeah.
Have you seen any positive change? I mean, you just said that you are kind of pessimistic, so maybe that answers the question. But no. Is there anything good, are there good things coming out of it?
Oh, of course. You know, it's easy to get wrapped up in all of the negative stuff. But, you know, the uprising that has happened from Standing Rock, my goodness. I didn't think I would see anything like that in my lifetime.
It's pretty big.
Yeah, yeah. It is.
And changing all the time. I mean, there's still news. I was just looking headlines.
Yeah. There's still things happening. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
You can't, you know, it changes all the time, but
Where
are we at the moment?
Standing Rock trained up warriors, yeah. You know? Like, what actually happened at Standing Rock is that thousands of people came in and they learned nonviolent direct action. So they learned frontline training. They learned the power of arts as messaging. So they learned all kinds of tools to create, you know, invaluable messaging. Because the one thing that you can control is that when the media comes, they won't tell your story. You know, quite often they're not there to tell your story. So if you can have art, if you can be on the front line with your messaging, you know, water is life, Maniwichoni, everyone knows that, then it doesn't matter what the story they're telling is. You're controlling the narrative just with your art, your creativity, your messaging. So, you know, all kinds of kids came in and they learned those tools. And now they're working in other communities to help them. And so there's been a complete shift in infrastructure. We now have an infrastructure of Indigenous warriors, protectors, activists who are ready to deploy at any moment, and that is pretty cool.
Hmm. And in covering Standing Rock, with it having so much of a global attention,
yeah.
got
yeah.
there in the end, has the way other outlets covered it, certainly, you know, you coming as a Native American crew would understand protocols and ways to cover an issue such as this, is there flow on signs that maybe other media outlets are cottoning onto that, or is there not great signs of how they're covering?
I think it's both. Yeah. I think, you know, when Standing Rock was sort of in its peak in, you know, late October, November of last year, I saw dozens of GoFundMes, you know, like online crowdfunding websites that were for non-Indigenous crews to get themselves to Standing Rock.
Yeah, right.
And I think that that's problematic because we're talking about, you know, Indigenous people who actually need to get there to stand up. So to have, there was a real conversation around privilege and poverty porn. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, what, where do you draw the line? So I think people learned what's not acceptable because they learned from being on the ground. But a lot of the coverage was problematic. Just the idea that people refused to say protector. We were labeled as protesters in every single major media, and we had asked, we're not protesting anything. We're protecting our homelands.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How much do you know or how much do you look into about the situation or the different issues facing Indigenous communities here in Australia? I mean, not that it's your job or whatever, but
no,
I like
to know what's up with all Indigenous people across the world. And then I have a couple cool connections to Australia. So I danced with a company in New York City called Untitled Collective, which is run by Ian Colless, who is an incredible, incredible force. He wrote the first Indigenous dance sort of reference book that's now used at your universities here, and he's Australian. He's from the Blue Mountains.
Mm-hmm. I've been there.
Yeah. So I got to learn a lot of really amazing Aboriginal dance techniques, and they were put all into the context of contemporary dance also. So that was really, really cool, like gateway into movement for me. That's because I'm a dancer at heart. Mm-hmm. Coming in through movement is something that is really cool and important for me. But my sister is in a band called Digging Roots, and she's been touring extensively through Australia for almost all of last year, and she'll be back again for almost all of next year. She comes back and she's here for 6 months. Mm-hmm. So her and her two boys and her husband, you know, came back just like totally pumped about the things that are happening here and the community here, because we see the situation as very similar. We see each other as allies. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're still not recognized in the Constitution. That's their current struggle, right?
Yeah.
And
right.
So
absolutely.
I follow that quite closely. Also, this conversation about treaties, like, I don't know if treaties are as important as we think they are in the future, because every treaty that we've ever entered into has been broken.
Right.
So yeah. From that side of the world, like from my side of the world, I think, you know, oh man, is there something better? But I don't know what it is. That's the problem. But what I do know is that treaties haven't worked for us.
So, yeah. It's been interesting for me coming from the U.S. and having, I come from the East Coast, and there's just very little. You don't see Native Americans around.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only until I traveled a little bit and went west that you see different communities. And here it seems it's smaller. It's more, there seems to be more integration. But I also work here. And
yeah, we have an Indigenous broadcast.
And we have
the
a channel. So it's just, I mean, I'm just really interested in the differences and mm-hmm. how it works, because you told the story before we started recording, but the perception on either side is so different.
Yeah.
I'm not really getting to a question.
No, I think I like what you're saying.
I'm just jumping in and swimming around in the mud trying to figure something out. But
are you from New York on the East
yes.
Coast? Okay, so I went to university in New York.
So did my brother.
Okay. I went to Alvin Ailey, so that's where I went for dance.
Oh.
That was the first environment where I was ever said, anyone ever said to me, there's no Indians anymore.
Yeah. I mean, that's what it looks like.
Yeah. The thing is that also on the East Coast, I mean, no one can see us because it's a podcast, but I don't think that I look incredibly identifiably Indigenous either. But a lot of people look like me where I'm from. And I have green eyes, sort of olive skin, and, you know, this kind of idea. Whereas I think people are looking for the romanticized imagery of what Indigenous people should look like. And just a little fact, that was actually purposeful. So when they were doing those Hollywood Westerns, when all of the showcasing of Indigenous people happened in the, you know, 60s, 70s, you know, even earlier, they chose to use Plains Indians. and I'm using the word Indians because that's what they were doing, that they chose that demographic because they were actually trying to push all of the nations from the coasts into that territory. Mm-hmm. And they were trying to make everyone think of us as one tribe because it's easier to control us if we are one nation that is in one place. So all of that, even the way we were perceived in Hollywood, was purposeful.
Right, right.
Yeah. But East Coaster, you know, that's where first contact happened. So yeah. That's where you're seeing the most intermixing also. So okay. A lot of the indigenous people on the East Coast look totally non-native.
Right, right.
Yeah.
I mean, all the names of all the towns are Native American.
Everything.
Some, everything is...
Like Poughkeepsie and like yeah, all yeah. of these things yeah, are... Yeah. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's similar to here, except, you know, I don't want to speak too much out of turn here about anything that I don't know everything about, but it's interesting.
You know what? One of the really cool things we were having a conversation earlier about is the other really similar fight that's going on is a fight against appropriation. So, you know, we're talking about headdresses and mm-hmm. all of these things,
yes.
But I heard this controversy over the Chanel boomerang recently. Chanel made a boomerang that really offended people, and I think we have the same kind of things, you know, like...
Chanel, the...
The brand.
The
brand.
Perfume company?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, like... Right. And so we have a lot of these same conversations. It's, you know, what is intellectual property? What is cultural ownership? And how do we share those things? You know, mm-hmm. do we feel like we're being honored? Because that's often the argument. Well, I don't ever feel like I'm being honored when I see someone in a neon headdress.
No.
Hasn't yet to happen, so.
No. I mean, the Halloween costumes is still out of control. And that happens a lot here, too, with the... There's a lot of blackface.
Well, there is a lot of
controversies.
And there's a lot of columns of... Is it okay? Is it okay to do blackface? So it's like we're still having those kind of conversations in some of the media where we haven't gotten past that. No, it's not okay. Let's not ever do it. So we're still yet to move forward on that.
So we've got a coin now called redface. That's what we're talking about in Canada, because I don't know why that hadn't happened sooner. But blackface, redface, it all makes sense, right?
Mm. My wife was looking for something for my child to play in, and there are places that sell teepees.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Which is very uncomfortable.
Oh,
it just seems like something you wouldn't sell to children.
Almost everyone's kid I know in Canada has one of those play teepees.
Oh,
and it's been some very interesting dinner conversation where I walk into someone's house and there's a dream catcher and a teepee and, you know, they have all of the things and the play tomahawk. And I think there is an innocence about it. I don't think people go out maliciously trying to, you know, to appropriate and to hurt someone. But it's just proof that the narrative is still there and that nothing has changed enough in people's consciousness to be like, oh, this is not okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's not the second guessing. It's
this
is what's done there for.
So it's proof that the work is still needing to be
done. Oh, totally.
Yeah.
A lot more theories of rise to come, I think.
That's kind of the most innocuous versions, because there's people aggressively defending the mascots of sports teams, which is just terrible. It's just so terrible and obvious. This is not cool. Let's stop this right now. But people dig in and double down. And
yeah, we just lost the most recent lawsuit against the Redskins. They will keep their logo and they will keep their name.
Yeah.
It's awful.
Mm.
Yeah.
For the audience, there's American sports teams whose mascots are caricatures of Native Americans. The Redskins, and then there's the Indians, Chief
mm-hmm.
Wahoo,
mm-hmm.
which is a preposterous cartoon head.
Yeah, and I think the what's even the most problematic part of that is the fans. You know, when people come to the stadiums, they come dressed in full red face. So that's still going on in North America too.
Yeah.
but they also get called out. So that's encouraging slightly that people are noticing, and there's blog posts and
there's movement.
And
we have allies. I think Indigenous people now have worldwide allies. And maybe we always had them, but the power of social media has meant that, you know, I've met allies. I get messages from people who have very different views, who had no idea that there was this kind of, you know, ongoing struggle for Indigenous people. And I think that's important. You know, I want to believe that with education, people would make different decisions. I want to believe that in the future, when people know the truth of our histories, our collective histories, that they will feel differently about their actions. But they just haven't known. We still don't even have a chapter in our history books in Canada on our real history. So,
what are people taught in schools? Like, are kids taught? Do they have that? Do they get the full
story?
Sort of.
I mean, Canada has this reputation of being, you know, really quote unquote woke. I hate that word, but I was like, but you know, we have this imagery to the rest of the world that we are very, you know, we're liberals and we are doing good things, but we don't get taught anything about residential schools. They have a small blurb, you know. I think that's just starting to change right now, but I didn't learn anything about my people in school. And I think we just celebrated Canada 150, which means that they're still teaching Canadians that Canada is 150 years old. Well, sure, Canada the country is, but the land, the territory, is thousands and thousands of years old. And so to be left out of the narrative of Canada 150 was a pretty big slap in the face for most Indigenous people. There was billions of dollars spent on it. Billions and billions of dollars. It was actually traumatic. I chose not to participate in any of the events that weekend.
Right.
Yeah.
Is there another series in Rise?
We haven't heard any word yet on season two, so we're still staying tuned for that. But I just finished working on another series with APTN, which is our Aboriginal People's Television Network, called Future History. And it's me and an archaeologist. I'm the future. He's the history. And he grew up without any of his teaching. So he has a very different view on finding Indigenous culture. And of course, I grew up with my teaching. So together we go out and we interview incredible movers and shakers who are using their culture to reappropriate and rematriate Indigenous culture and Indigenous knowledge.
So cool.
Just wrapped that last Friday.
Oh, brilliant.
Nice.
Yeah.
So on now, shall we, sort of music and TV, pop culture kind of podcast, and we love to ask our guests what they've been watching, sort of loving, hating, anything, everything. What are you, a big movie watcher or TV watcher? What's?
Oh my goodness, yes. And now you're going to ask me the tough question after I fly.
Yeah.
Oh, what have I been watching lately?
Did you watch anything on the plane?
Oh, yeah, but I watched ridiculous things on the plane.
Oh, everyone watches.
Everyone does. Everyone does.
I watched a documentary on wine, well, it was because there was this big wine scandal.
Yes.
Where this guy had all this fake wine and it was millions of
dollars. He was selling it for lots of money. Yeah,
yeah, that's right. Yeah, and I watched that one.
Are you a big wine person?
No. Right. To be honest, it was the first thing. And we were taking off, and I just pushed it.
Just jumped right in.
There's only like five documentaries. I love documentaries, you know. So right now in Canada, there's like so much really cool stuff going on. But Imaginative is that's actually the world's largest Indigenous film festival. And the director of Rise, she's working on a feature film that's coming up called An Inconvenient Indian. And that's going to be coming out soon. I'm really excited for that.
Nice.
But let's see. Oh my gosh, you guys.
You watch superhero movies? Just pick a superhero movie.
No, I'm not going to pick a superhero movie. I want to say one movie. Do you edit this or is it all live? Just one second.
We'll have a seamless edit here.
Have you seen any Harry Potter movies?
Oh my gosh, yes. I've seen all the Harry Potter movies.
What else?
Well, I've got one. It was at the Sydney Film Festival a couple of weeks ago. The doc about the role of Native American music in jazz and...
Okay, so Rumble. Yes. Rumble's a great doc. Mm. So Jesse Davis, whom a lot of people don't know about. Thank you for giving me
I loved
one.
It. Yeah. And now TV actually have
Wait,
it.
Have
We're
you seen
be
it?
Screening
yeah,
it soon.
Yeah, so... Yeah, I have.
Like how I handballed that one to you.
Despite my, like, failure to have words right now. So Rumble is actually really cool. My sister's in that also.
Oh, nice.
Mm-hmm. But Rumble premiered at Sundance with us. So Rise premiered at Sundance in January of last year. And Rumble was also a part of that. So also I grew up in the music industry. Mm. So just being around a lot of Indigenous music, Rumble was cool because...
It's a great movie.
Yeah, it was cool because there's a lot of things that people don't realize, like, you know, Link Ray.
Yeah.
Gray was Native. Jessie Davis, who's on every... Jessie Davis, my favorite guitar player also of all time. But for people who don't know who are listening, he was from Oklahoma City. He had that, like, classic Oklahoma twang that you can't reproduce. But he was Native, and he played on, I'm sure, a lot of everyone's favorite records. He played on every Neil Diamond record. He played with the band, Leon Russell. He was just a studio guy who was on everyone's records, but he only had two records of his own. And so, you know, he didn't really get his own solo career, but, you know, there was an Indigenous guy on a lot of mainstream music, which I thought was really cool to know. So.
Yeah. And I don't know that I'm breaking any rules here, but, I, you know, we've bought that for tip show on NITV coming up whenever it's available to us. But yeah, it's
awesome.
Great.
Fantastic.
It's really cool. But you know what? There are so many amazing things going on. I encourage people to just like look up like Taika Waititi, who's from New Zealand. Like just like there's a lot of really amazing things going on right now. A lot of amazing coverage of Indigenous issues and a lot of amazing storytellers who are just sort of bringing back our voice in the mainstream, which is cool.
It's very exciting.
It is. Well, thank you so much for coming in.
Yeah,
it's
been thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Thank you. Delight to talk to you.
I would say chimigwech. That means thank you so much for having me.
I had a great time talking to her. She was fantastic.
Really lovely.
Rise premieres on SBS Viceland on Thursday, July 27 at 9 p.m. And all episodes will be available on SBS On Demand right after they are broadcast. What have you been watching?
Edgar Wright's Baby Driver.
Yeah, there were parts of it that I wasn't that into. There was some Pulp Fiction-y, we're people in movies, so we talk like this type stuff. But and that slowed things down for me in parts. But I can't remember the last time I was that exhilarated by a movie. I left it feeling like I wanted to get in my more modest automobile. And
open it up on the highway.
Yeah, and yeah, tear the streets up. But it was
see what this baby can do.
I liked it.
Sure. I mean, I liked it too. That's the most qualified comment I can make. No, I did. I'm baffled by the outpouring of excitement around it, saying it's so totally fresh and invigorating and blah, blah. I mean,
do you think the excitement has carried through to the, I mean, it's been out for a week or so now.
Yeah,
at
true.
This point. Is it done?
Oh, I think people who were excited probably still are. I'm talking about which met it at its release.
Right.
Look, it is good. I guess it does stand out compared to the glut of sequels and franchise movies. So it is a standalone film that is enjoyable and fun and has a soundtrack and has an energy to it that a lot of films are lacking. I had an issue with the backstory. Like, I don't need to know why Baby Driver is who he is. My eyes rolled deep into the back of my head when it's explained it's because his mum died and there's a mixtape, and it's all, that got very Guardians of the Galaxy for me as well. And I don't know the filmmaker's own personal history, so if it does touch into something like that, you know, apologies in advance. But I don't think it does. But it's a trope now. The mum is sort of this absent angel who, you know, is really just an excuse to give a bit of backstory to explain the characters. I tire of that very quickly. So that for me was a bit, really? I'm going to do that? But the music's fun. Great stunts. I love a good car movie.
How does it compare to his other movies, do you think?
Oh, well, you know, he does bring a sensibility to them and there's a fun freshness to them. So, you know, I do like that. I just don't think it's revolutionary and amazing and just the best thing ever, which is some of the enthusiasm I've been seeing. But granted, that's on Twitter and that's how Twitter responds to things. They love it or hate it and never the twain shall meet. And it's got John Hamm, so I'm okay with that too.
Yeah, right. It's not an original movie like this, which I really appreciate because they're so few and far between these days. But Atomic Blonde is out this week. I saw that. And I think overall it's pretty good. But there's a 5-minute sequence that is really incredible, and I think it's a fight sequence, and Charlize Theron is unbelievable in it. I don't know if I'm sold on her in general, and I wanted to ask you what you thought of her, because
I'm not sure how I feel, but it's just this one sequence was amazing.
What do you mean you're not sure about her?
Like, I don't
her
know.
Skills.
Yeah,
as
I don't know. I don't know how I feel about her.
Fury Road, did you watch that?
Oh, she was great in that.
Yeah.
Oh, she's on a roll. Well, no, see, I don't.
You seem like you've come right around.
I don't know how good she is acting wise in this movie.
Okay, I haven't
but
seen it.
But fighting, she's incredible.
She's a great physical actress, yeah.
Yes.
And I guess same with Fury Road as well. I think she's great. She's got her Oscar and she got it for Monster.
Yeah.
For me, that's probably not the role that stands out as her best. Felt like Impersonation as she in that. I didn't think it was amazing.
You liked her more in November Rain?
Charlotte,
what about the cedar? The cedar.
Cider House Rules.
The Cedar House Rules.
We could just list her filmography. That about wraps it up. Put some notes about the episode online with recommended links to the shows and movies we've been talking about. Make sure you subscribe and give us a review wherever you get your podcasts from. And if you have any questions for us, get in touch with us on Facebook or Twitter at SBS Movies. I'm Fiona Williams. You can catch me on Twitter at anythingbutfifi.
And I'm on Twitter at Nick Bassine.
And our producer is Dan Barrett. Thanks for listening.